So throughout the world, traditional societies are wanting to acquire some things from modern outside society. But this acquisition is selective. And I think the important thing is that traditional societies should be free to make their own choice rather than be dragged into the modern world against their will, notably by being exterminated, driven off the land, conquered, dispossessed.
And there's a lady right in front of that gentleman.
One thing that I noted when I lived in Hawaii for 20 years is that many, many grandparents were raising their grandchildren. And my mother was 42 when she had us, which was almost an impossibly unfashionable age. And I noted the same two things, that the older the parent was in many, the grandparent was in many instances, the children wound up almost losing a generation of perspective alternatives because of their grandparents. They grew up more racist, frankly. They grew up more superstitious, and they grew up with a kind of ethos that didn't necessarily suit them for the generation that they were entering. That's the one caution that I have when I look at what you're suggesting.
Sure, fair enough. I mean, all of you parents of young children, you got to figure out, how much caregiving do you want to turn over to your parents, the grandparents of the children? In many cases, among my friends, many of my friends are utterly thrilled to have their children looked after by their grandparents. And others of my friends say there is no way that, seriously, that my kids are going to get looked after by the grandparents. So I'm not making a universal recommendation. I'm merely saying that nowadays, under modern circumstances, grandparents, if they want to do it, and if the parents want them to do it, are more valuable than in the past because of the demographic changes.
Question right in the front row here. Could you wait for the mic, please?
Just as a follow-up of that, when you're comparing roles, somebody can be a grandparent, I would assume, at a much younger age in many traditional societies than you would perhaps become a grandmother here. So that could affect role, too. So
absolutely.
How, in your studies, how did you compensate for age-related roles?
By acknowledging that in my lecture. And I mentioned the caveat that a downside, yes, there's an upside to increased role of grandparenting today with more and more childbearing age people out in the workforce. But a downside is exactly as you say, that people are becoming grandparents not in their 35s, 40s, 45s as they used to, but 70s and 80s. I'm 75 and I'm not yet a grandparent, which means that when I finally, hopefully, become a grandparent, I'm going to have less energy than when I was 40 years old. So it's something that one has to be aware of.
I heard some time back of something called the grandmother theory, which suggested that human brain development was encouraged in a time long ago when grandmothers took over care of the children so that the mother could do other foraging activities, such as that way, way back in the foraging days. Hmm. I'm thinking about that versus the changes now where the grandmother isn't necessarily part of the picture.
That phenomenon that you mentioned for Taiwan, grandparents, grandmothers taking over responsibility for the kids while the parents of the kids go off forage, that observation that you made for Taiwan is widespread. It's also the case that I mentioned for the Hadza, and I would say it's the case in most, maybe all, hunter-gatherer societies that have been observed, that the grandparents, if they're still alive and capable of doing it, often take responsibility, staying in camp and looking after the children, looking after their grandchildren, thereby freeing up their own children, the parents of the grandchildren, to go off hunting and gathering, freeing them up. Not just Taiwan, but it's a widespread phenomenon.
Well, I wasn't talking about Taiwan, but it was
the educational possibilities and the information being passed on by grandparents that we know parents don't do as much as grandparents do, a family.
Also, grandparents have 30 or 40 more years behind them to acquire information to pass on to their grandchildren.
You touched briefly on the differences in warfare between traditional and modern societies. Could you say more about that, please?
Yeah, the differences in warfare between traditional and modern societies come as a big surprise to people who hear about them. Often, traditional societies are idealized as peaceful, but there are lots of studies of traditional tribal societies, and the cruel reality is that the percentage of traditional people who die violent deaths is higher than in almost any state society for which we have information. If you want to compare the worst of the worst, Germany, Russia, and Poland during 20th century, the chances of dying of war or violent death in any of those countries during the 20th century are several times lower than the chances of dying a violent death in most traditional societies. And the reason, it's not that people in traditional societies are more vicious. It's that war is an intermittent affair in modern societies with government, because the government declares war and then it declares peace. And when the government declares peace, hot-headed young men who want to start a war again are restrained from starting the war. Whereas in traditional societies, without a centralized government, there isn't a government that restrains the hotheads from going back to war again. So the reality is that traditional societies are at war almost constantly, modern societies only intermittently, and the numbers show that the chances of dying a violent death in traditional societies, something like 10 times the chances, 10 or 20 times the chances in state-level society. That's been a big surprise.
Culturally, you've seen that some societies value older people more, and you've kind of expounded upon that to some length. I was just wondering if they do things more economically efficiently that sort of incentivizes that behavior at a certain level. I mean, are they better at taking care of their elderly than we are?
Are they better at taking care of the elderly than we are? Are traditional societies better at taking care of the elderly than we are? It depends upon what you mean by better. Our society certainly can give much better, can give medical care to the elderly. The traditional societies cannot. Our societies, by and large, fail at providing a socially satisfying life for the elderly, because the reality is that with Americans moving every 5 years, it's very difficult to reconstruct the lifelong social circle for an old person. Whereas in traditional societies, people spend their lives where they grew up, and so you're going to spend your last years surrounded by your children and your relatives and your friends. Nothing special is required to produce that result. Mixed bag.
We have a lot of questions, but not a lot of time. There's a gentleman right behind you, and then we'll come toward the front.
Thank you. I wonder if you can say anything about the relationship that each society has with their own environment in terms of the sustainability and projection for survival that they have.
Big question, relationship of people with their own environment in terms of sustainability and survival. There's variation. There are traditional societies that have exterminated, overutilized and exterminated resources that are important to them. The reason why, when you step outside this building, you're not going to see on the street a elephant or lion or giant ground sloth or camel or any of the animals that used to be in North America 14,000 years ago is very likely because of the overhunting of the large animals of North America and South America by human colonists. Eleanor Ostrom, the famous economist for the University of Indiana, and this may be a good note, in fact, on which to sum things up for the last question. Eleanor Ostrom was interested in the question you raised. What are the circumstances under which traditional societies manage their resources well, and under what circumstances do they overexploit their resources as we are doing today? And to sum up a life's work for which he got a Nobel Prize in one or two sentences, Eleanor Ostrom found that traditional societies were much more likely to take good care of and to manage sustainably their resources under two conditions. First, if they could exclude outsiders, and be the only ones themselves utilizing those resources. And secondly, if they had confidence, they would pass on the resources to their own children. If they were confident, they would pass on that fishery, that land, those forests to their own children. And if they were sure that they would keep outsiders out, then they would take good care of the resources. Whereas if they couldn't exclude outsiders, and if they were not confident they could pass on the resources to their kids, then they reason correctly. Somebody else is going to chop those trees down, so we might as well do it ourselves. That's perhaps a good note on which to end.
An interesting thought there. Are our children going to inherit the earth, or is it going to be the corporations that get there first? Now, the following piece is by Against the Grain Radio from July the 11th, 2012.
I'm Sasha Lilly. Our society is permeated with deeply held beliefs about ourselves and each other, which we think are rooted in biology. For example, many of us assume that men are aggressive by nature and that stereotypically male behavior has evolutionary origins, dating back to when men were hunters. We also tend to believe that humans, or at least women, are naturally monogamous, and many of us still believe that different racial groups exist amongst humans. Biological anthropologist Agustin Fuentes has set out to upend these beliefs, which he says are based on erroneous understandings of evolution. To that end, he has written Race, Monogamy, and Other Lies They Told You, Busting Myths About Human Nature, published by the University of California Press. He teaches at the University of Notre Dame and joins me by phone. Agustin, there are three sets of myths about race, about aggression, and about sex that you believe are based on questionable assumptions about human nature. So I'd like to start there. Is there something that we can call human nature that cuts across time and place?
That's a very good question, and it's almost an answer in and of itself. I mean, being human is a fairly distinctive thing to be, but there isn't one way to be human. So I prefer the term human natures. There's many potential outcomes for being human. We become and are human in many different ways across the planet. And so what I'm really interested in is understanding, how do those ways turn out? How do we become human, and how do we act across this broad spectrum? So is there one single way to be human? No. Are there lots of potential ways to be human? Yes.
Which, of course, gets right into the heart of questions about biology, genetics, and then the larger questions about how society shapes us as well. But is there something that we can point to that's biological that constitutes these human nature or natures?
Sure. I mean, we can talk about a bunch of characteristics that unite humans, but any one of those characteristics can be shared by many other organisms. I mean, a lot of things that humans have that are fairly distinctive are our large brains, but we share that with some other primates and dolphins and whales. Another one you could say our use of language and symbol. Now, that is pretty distinctive, but other animals have incredible ways of communicating. I think what's really impressive about humans is this incredible ability to get along, to engage one another, and to use symbol and ideas and imagination that's more than just their bodies. So if you had to say sort of what are some of the characteristics of human natures, it would almost be an extended mind, a social self that's more than just individuals.
And how does this then connect to how you see the extended ongoing debate about when we think of ourselves, what shapes us, the degree to which it's nature, the degree to which it's nurture, whether there is some place which is both of those? How should we understand that perennial dichotomy?
Well, I think one of the biggest mistakes is that people use the terms nature and nurture as if they were two separate things. They never exist independent of one another. That is, we do not exist without what we grow up in, what we experience, but at the same time, what we grow up in, what experience has no bearing on us without understanding our biology. So the two are always together. In my book, I coined a term called nature-nurtural, for lack of a better way to present this. Humans are simultaneously biological and cultural all the time. Now, we can take a chunk of flesh and talk about its biology, but that biology, when it's part of us, always is in a cultural context. Our nose is a biological feature of our face, but it's also a major cultural component of our daily lives. So trying to sort of differentiate how much is biology and how much is culture can really be antithetical to understanding what it means to be human.
Okay, well, with that said, one of the fundamental things that has a bearing on how we understand the world around us, for good or for ill, is evolution. And your book focuses on assumptions about whether there are actual racial differences between people, if there's something that can be considered race. You look at the role of aggression and whether there are differences between men and women about aggression, and then you also look at gender differences as well. We're going to explore those different themes over the course of this program, but they're all rooted in some major assumptions that are made about evolution. How do we tend to misunderstand evolution, and what are the consequences of doing so?
This is a very important point. I mean, it's a real problem with our educational system in the United States. Most people misunderstand evolution. Evolution is simply change over time. Now, when we're talking about biological evolution, we're just talking about that things on this planet that are alive, forms of organisms, have changed over the course of the history of the planet, period. That's evolution. And what's fascinating about evolution is the detailed studies that let us understand how and why things change. And so that's the theory of evolution, our ideas that are well supported about how these changes happen. So the biggest problem with popular misunderstandings of evolution is they tie it into this nature red tooth and claw, this idea that everything is out there fighting all the time and whoever's bigger, faster, meaner wins. That, in fact, is not at all what evolution is about, but it is translated into that in the popular venue all too often.
Right, so survival of the fittest.
Yeah, exactly. The survival of the fittest doesn't even make any sense. If you actually understand the way evolutionary processes work, the term fit or fittest means those individuals that have a suite of characteristics that do well in a given environment. So really, survival of the fittest means standing of those who stand. It's nonsensical and it's tautological. It's a circular argument. Darwin never meant to argue that everything is always fighting for success. In fact, Darwin was a big fan of cooperation. And research over the last 200 years since Darwin's time has really demonstrated to us, yes, competition is important in the world around us, but the cooperation drives the evolution of systems much more frequently than does competition.
Isn't there also an element in the common way evolution tends to be understood popularly? It's almost as if evolution has some destination, which is towards a kind of sort of an inevitable progress. Tell us more about why we should be really skeptical and cautious with the popular conception of evolution.
Right. Well, slime molds are a good example of that. It's this sort of mucousy slime stuff that's been around for millions and millions of years. It's not progressing very fast, but it does extremely well on its own. Evolution doesn't have an endpoint. Evolution is a description of a process. It's not a thing. And I think that's really important. So the idea that things get bigger, faster, better, more precise is really a mistaken idea of evolution. And really, we take that from the 1800s and 1900s, when there was this idea that biology was going to improve humanity, or understanding it would improve us, and that evolution was then superimposed on racial, social, economic, political inequality and tried to be used to justify those kind of systems.
And when we think of evolution, don't we also tend to sort of see it as something that has happened? It's in the past, and that the story is over. Is that right, in fact, true?
No, it's absolutely false. It's not that we have evolved, it's that we are evolving. And I think that's something that people miss all the time. 10,000 years from now, things will be different. 10,000 years ago, things were different. But that's not a bad thing. It's important to understand that biological, social, cultural, ecological processes are always in flux and dynamic. If we understand that, we have a much better opportunity to sort of step back and look at our world and ourselves and see how we fit in it.
Are these questions around evolution controversial? The zoologist Richard Dawkins, who is famous, has been made very famous for his defense of atheism, I guess popularly, argued that human nature is based on the evolution of selfish genes competing with each other. Are these sort of contested questions?
Well, yes and no. They're not contested in the data. They're contested in the public. The point is that actually Dawkins' argument is more complex than that. But the way it's perceived in the public is that we have selfish genes competing for representation every generation, and we're the vehicles for those selfish genes, and that competition and selfishness drives organic or biological systems. We know that not to be true. That is not the case. There's plenty of data out there that shows that. That is something that arose out of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, out of the mindsets and the social political agendas of individuals that were then placed on our current understanding of biology and genetics at the time. we now know a lot more about biology and genetics, and we know that while selfish paradigms might be at play in some bodily systems and some genetic ways of modeling, that's not the way in which life evolves or genes work.
Well, what are the political implications of these kinds of questions? Because it seems that a lot of political arguments get framed around what is natural. If we can sort of identify what is natural, what has evolved, then we can say how things should be.
Exactly. Well, that's the famous problem with how things should be and how things are. But the problem there really lies in this idea that biology is right and culture is wrong, or culture is a superficial thing we lay on our true deep selves. And that's just not true. The anthropologist John Marks pointed out recently, humans have always been biocultural. That is, our arms, our bodies, our cells never exist without human culture, and vice versa. So trying to sort of say what's natural or normal for humans gives us this huge range of potential behavior, and that's going to make people really uncomfortable. So they tend to fall back on using a hypothetical naturalness for the kinds of social and political agendas that they want to put forward.
Well, you just mentioned culture. Can you actually define that term? What does it mean? Because it's certainly important in the argument that you make.
Well, there's a number of different definitions of culture. The best way to think about it is it's what we do, think, and feel. It's that giant sort of soup of symbol and ideology and language and knowledge that we move through and that influences and shapes the way in which we see the world. Culture is all of those things that surround humans that are passed and transmitted on. Now, we can talk about different bits of culture, but that's not as helpful. It's better to think of this as a sort of broad engagement with a symbolic, ideological, linguistic reality that are everyday lives.
Well, let's move to one of the realms that you take on in your book, which is around race. There's a long history of race being defined as a biological category, something that has come through evolution. And yet, as you argue, it's entirely faulty. But it's something that has a great deal of influence on how people think about themselves and each other. So tell us how this notion of race as a biological category came to be and why it's so wrong.
Well, let me actually clarify that, because there's something that's very important in there that's often problematic in this conversation. The topic is very difficult. So the first thing I want to clarify is there is a biological definition of race that zoologists use, people who study animals, right? You can measure it genetically and morphologically. A race is sort of a clearly definable unit within a species that is measurably distinct in a clear and developmental and evolutionary way from other units in that species. That sounds a little complicated, but let's just say that you can measure these things genetically. When you apply those same tests that you would to wood rats or deer or wolves or pumas to humans, humans do not have biological races. That is, we are currently not divided up into biological races. Now, maybe 30,000 years ago when there were Neanderthals and humans running around, maybe there was more than one human race. But currently there's only one biological human race. So that's the first very important thing. Humans do not fit the criteria of the kinds of divisions that zoologists use to classify organisms into different subspecies. The second part of this question is the much more sort of complicated and dangerous one, and that is the idea that we can tell differences between groups of peoples, however we want to define them, and that some of those differences have some sort of biological factors, and then people then interpret that as meaning that there are biological differences between these groups. And skin color is really the best example of that, and it's one of the most misunderstood in public, but yet at the same time, very, very, very well understood scientifically. The book Skin by Nina Jablonski is a perfect example of that.
Can you tell us more about then, because skin seems such an obvious one, right? It's an obvious difference between people, how those differences came to be and how we should understand them.
Well, first of all, we tend to think in North America that we understand human variation. We see almost nothing. To really understand how humans vary, even just based on skin color, you'd need to walk from California up across the North Pole. Well, actually, let's go down to Tierra del Fuego in Chile and then walk all across South and Central and North America, walk over into Asia, walk through Asia, walk down into Southeast Asia, back up into Asia, down through Western Asia, through Europe, and then all across Africa. That's the only way you can get an understanding of what variation looks like. Here in the United States, we have very, very limited variation or exposure to what people look like. So having said said that, in our country, we identify white, black, Asian, sometimes brown, sometimes red, these different skin colors. But what that's really talking about is just variations in the reflectance level of people's skin. Skin color actually comes in only two forms in humans. We have this pigment called melanin, and it only comes in brown and black. And it's the relative density of melanin and its distribution in your skin that sort of gives you different reflectance levels. That is not characteristic of populations in the broadest sense. That is, you have very dark-skinned populations all across the globe, not just in, say, for example, sub-Saharan Africa. You have them in Asia. You have them in South America. You also have light-skinned populations all across the globe. The only pattern that skin color really tells you about is how much ancestry you have relative to the equator. It is the closer to the equator your ancestry is around the planet, the darker your skin is likely to be. And that has to do with evolution, this adaptation to the kind of intense ultraviolet radiation over long-term exposure for peoples from the equatorial regions.
But then how should we understand diseases that seem to affect particular ethnic groups? They tend to be sometimes viewed through that kind of racial or biological lens.
Exactly. So the problem is ethnicity and race are not the same thing at all. So in the United States, we use the term, say, white or European-American or black and African-American. And the problem is these are social categories, right, representing clusters of people from a bunch of different sort of populational backgrounds on the planet. Now, in the United States, those classified white usually have a large representation of Western European or Northern European heritage, and many of those classified black have a large percentage of West African heritage. Now, it would be easy to say, well, maybe there's some diseases found in Western Europe and West Africa that show up in these populations. And in a very few cases, that's true, but that doesn't make them associated with all populations from West Africa or Western Europe. The most probably prevalent example would be sickle cell anemia. In North America, in the United States, we tend to associate sickle cell anemia with African Americans. But the point is, sickle cell anemia comes in multiple genetic forms and is found in high frequency in some African populations, in some populations from the Indian subcontinent, and in a lot of populations from the Arabian Peninsula. So it's not associated with black. It's, in fact, associated with particular populations in different parts around the planet. Does that make sense?
Indeed. You write in Race, Monogamy, and Other Lies that they told you about the faulty hypothesis that circulated in the late 1980s based on some of these presumptions about race and biology and evolution that made a connection between hypertension amongst African Americans and salt and slavery. I wonder if you could tell us about that argument and what it really illustrates about some of these broader questions you're addressing.
Well, the argument is a perfect example of a misconception of history, biology, evolutionary theory, and a variety of other things. The idea is that if you look at, across the United States, people of African descent, African Americans, blacks, however you want to categorize them, in some places in the U.S., tend to have higher levels of hypertension and hypertension-related disorders than do other ethnic groups in the United States, on average in some places. One of the arguments was that this is because during the slave ships and when the people were taken from Africa and brought over, that there was selection against, that is, evolutionary processes happened that weeded out certain individuals and kept in individuals that were very hardy and could do without water and had sort of higher salt concentrations in their blood. We know that's not true. But what's really interesting here is that instead of asking the question about social inequality, access to health care, life histories, diets, and the structure of our economic and healthcare systems, people want to look for a simple biological explanation for these major issues of inequality. And the problem with that is twofold. One, any simple explanation for something complicated about human health or behavior is probably going to be wrong. And two, if you just stop at what you think is a biological explanation, you can accept it as natural or a given, and probably not delve further into the scenario and try to really understand what's going on in a very complicated, maybe biocultural way, as opposed to just a biological way.
And so just to be clear, while you're arguing that race actually doesn't exist, racism itself as a socially produced understanding of race, that is real and has very real consequences.
Yeah, the biologist, biological anthropologist Lance Gravley has a great phrase. He says, a race is not biology, but racism becomes biology. That is social inequality. This is around the world. We know that social inequality changes or inequality in access to health care, nutrition, a variety of other things can lead to actual physiological differences in people, in ethnic groups or in populations. So racism or structured inequality can have direct impacts on our body. That doesn't mean that those bodies come from populations that are distinct groups within humanity.
Well, can you give us some other examples of that, the ways that while racism may not be based on biology, it actually affects biology?
Sure. I mean, we can think a lot about obesity issues. We can talk, there's some recent publications in the Journal of American Medical Association and The Lancet and others showing radically differential access to healthcare in different parts of the world, in the United Kingdom, in North America, and that differential access to healthcare impacts things like overall heart health, obesity, longevity, that is life expectancy. And one of the most sort of really brutal statistics in the United States is infant mortality. Right now in the United States, infant mortality, that is the number of deaths of infants per 1,000 births, is twice in African Americans what it is in whites. And that's not because there's any discernible, measurable, contiguous, or consistent biological differences. That's because of a radical history of inequality.
Agustin Fuentes, you also take a close look at aggression. There is a presumption that as a species, humans are aggressive and that men in particular are particularly aggressive and that society somehow reigns in this basic animalistic nature that left unchecked would run amok. Before we get to your critique of that notion, what's the argument based on?
There's a large, very powerful history in our sort of Western orientation, philosophical and theological orientation about what it means to be human. And this is tied in with this concept of original sin. It's also tied in with this concept of the beast and savagery versus civilization. This idea that at heart, we are what Thomas Hobbes called sort of beasts. That is, without the constraints of civilization or society, it will be back to this competition, fighting, the bigger, better, fastest, meanest individual will win out. That's a very strong way of thinking about humanity. And we see that evident all the time in public when there's riots or we take Katrina, for example, during the horrific hurricane there in New Orleans. Immediately, people began reporting about how people went nuts and there was raping and attacks and all the sort of animal instincts came up and people were being horrible to one another. But when you actually went back and looked at the data, what did people actually do? They spent an enormous amount of time caring for one another, helping each other. Yeah, there were some problems, but the truth is not that when you strip away civilization, people become beasts. It's actually that they cooperate and get along pretty well.
So particularly this argument around our beastly nature tends to focus on men. And of course, if you look at our society, you'll see that more violent crime is committed by men than it is by women. So is there a biological basis to this notion that men are particularly beset with aggression?
There is not. The same systems, the testosterone, right, the hormones, the same biological systems that function in men function in women, they function more or less the same ways. Psychological and sociological and anthropological data sets show us that both men and women use aggression, right, and both use physical aggression. However, in at least the societies that it's been studied, in particular a lot of Western societies, men tend to use physical aggression a little bit more than women. And because men are larger than women, the impact or the potential harm or injury from male physical aggression is higher. So men do engage a little bit more in physical aggression, it seems. But we can't just say that there's a biological difference there because we also have to think about gender and society and the way in which women are sort of engendered and brought up and the way in which men are engendered and brought up. It's very appropriate for a 12-year-old boy to throw a physical tantrum in public, but it's very inappropriate for a 12-year-old girl to throw a physical tantrum in public, even though both may want to do so. So, again, it's back to this biocultural, this natural, nurtural idea. Yes, there are some differences between men and women in sort of violence and aggression, but they're very, very small, much less than most people think. But to understand them and to understand our modern context, we really have to think about what do we grow up in? Who are we? How do we expect men? males and females to behave.
Is human aggression then an evolutionary adaptation? Is it, you know, wired deep in our history?
No, it is not. Human aggression is not an evolutionary adaptation. What our evolutionary histories have enabled us to do is to be incredibly violent when we choose to be. That is, we have great aggressive potential. Our ability to gather groups together, our ability to coordinate attacks or aggression is enormous and probably outpaces almost any other form of life on this planet. That doesn't mean that that arose in the past for that specific reason. That is, our ability to get people together probably has more to do with cooperating and raising children than it does with making war. But those same systems can be co-opted for different reasons in different social, historical, political, and economic contexts.
So in other words, you're saying that war and warfare is not a permanent, essential aspect of our nature?
Absolutely not. It's very prominent today, and it has been probably off and on for the last 6 to 10,000 years. The more cities we have, the more social inequality we have, the more technology we have, the more we can sort of use our ability to cooperate to wage war against one another. War is not going away, but it is not the end-all be-all. It's not what got us to where we are today, and it's not a given.
So can we then make any assumptions about our ability to be, say, egalitarian versus hierarchical, peaceful versus warlike? Can you make broad assumptions? Is it sort of, it cuts both ways? How should we understand that?
Yeah, I think it cuts both ways. And here's one of the problems with my book, with the way I argue, with the way in which we really, in an anthropological sense, understand the world. It's complicated. Being human is messy. It would be really nice if we could say we're warlike or we're egalitarian. We're neither. We have the potential to be both in some ways, but neither of those things are at our core. We're not more egalitarian than we are warlike or peaceful than we are aggressive. There's a lot of complexity to being human. Having said that, what we really want to do is ask the question, what do people actually do most of the time? So if 5 people were shot in New York City tomorrow, the headline in New York Times would read, 5 people shot in New York City. Okay, but what the headline we're never going to see is 14,995,995 people got along in New York City today. One of the important things is asking the question, what are people actually doing, and then how can we study what people do and then get a better idea of what our potential is? The problem is we focus on aggression, we focus on violence, we focus on what we think are racial differences, as opposed to stepping back and asking the broader questions, what's actually out there. And that's the whole point of my book. It's a toolkit to help people ask those questions.
So, Agustin, what do we learn when we compare ourselves to other primates, which your work focuses a great deal on? We hear that amongst primates that aggressive chimps get all the mates, that in a sense, some of our notions about ourselves seems to be drawn, perhaps patchily, from scientific reporting on how our closest relatives behave.
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I love watching monkeys and apes, the primates. I've done a lot of that. It's a fascinating sort of insight, not so much into what it means to be human, but what it means to be primates. I mean, humans are primates, so by looking at the whole group of primates, we can understand a little bit about sort of what aspects of ourselves are shared in common with all of our sort of closest biological kin. Now, the thing with chimpanzees is that a couple species, or at least subspecies of chimpanzees, are pretty aggressive. They fight against one another in communities. Males are very aggressive towards females. Sometimes they'll attack one another. Sometimes they'll attack, kill, and devour infants in their own group. We don't fully understand exactly why that is, but it's part of their social realities. So chimpanzees can be very violent, one species of them. The other species of chimpanzee that most people know as the bonobos, the pampaniscus, they don't fight that much. And when they do fight, most of their fights end up with sexual behavior. That is, they use sex to sort of get around physical aggression. So we have two species, both equally related to humans, and they show us sort of two distinct forms of what our human ancestry might be. The real punchline here is that neither of those, the bonobos or the chimpanzees, show us who humans are. What they do suggest to us, and what is suggested to us by looking at all of the other primates as well, that social complexity, that is getting together, living in a group, and having really complicated social relationships, is a core thing for primates. And the potential for aggression, for sex, for peace, for egalitarian, for hierarchical, all of those potentials are there. And so humans have that in our historical sort of evolutionary past, And the ways in which those different possibilities and potentials play out are very complicated in modern humans.
Well, and it raises an interesting question about science and the parallels that are made between humans and others. Some scientists draw from, I'm thinking of Edward Wilson, the founder of sociobiology, look at intensely social but very hierarchical societies like those of ants, and others study the much more egalitarian bonobos. When we try to understand ourselves, how do we make a decision about, you know, who to look to? Is that really a scientific question or a political question or both?
Well, here's my personal answer. It's a political question. Here's my answer as a scientist. It's a question of training. So those two things are somewhat different. Why we do what we do as scientists, when you go out to study an organism, be it a human or another organism, there's always some reason that you do that. I think what's very important is if you have the kind of training that tells you there is a truth out there, and by looking for one particular truth, you're going to find sort of support for your ideas, you're going to ask different kinds of questions and different kinds of research than if you go out there with what should be the goal of science, which is to prove yourself wrong. Remember, the science is just a method, and all it ever allows us to do is demonstrate support for hypotheses or refute them, show that they're wrong. We can never prove ourselves right. So that's a long way to sort of answer the question, and that is that we can't know about humans from any single other species. But by going out and looking at the diversity of life and understanding how other organisms make a living in the world, we can learn a little bit about how humans make a living in the world because of our continuities with nature, that is the world out there, and because of our discontinuities with the other forms of life on the planet.
Well, and it also, I guess, points to the role of culture in all of this and the fact that science doesn't exist alone in some kind of vacuum, and that in engaging with any of these questions, there will be a current, certainly a context in which ideas are examined and discarded or embraced.
Exactly. So I always tell people when I'm giving these public lectures or writing about these kinds of things, I don't want anyone to believe me or agree with me. I want them to understand how I've come to the conclusions I'm presenting and then be able to disarticulate those. That is, if you don't like what I'm saying, look at the data, look at the way in which things are presented, ask questions about how a statement is asserted and supported, and if it's not supported, then you can realize that it's probably not correct. That's, again, the point of the book, is that we have so much sort of use of the term science in public that's erroneous, that isn't talking about science the method, it's talking about scientism, sort of the idea that, well, if someone who's trained in a particular way says something, it's probably more correct than someone else. That's not true. What is potentially true is if someone has done good science and presents you with the data and some very strongly supported conclusions, then yeah, you should listen to that.
Right, and perhaps we'll return to this, but it also raises questions about our ability in the wider public to be able to differentiate between these things when there's so little education around science in the first place. I want to move to another part of your book, which looks at sex. There are so many assumptions that are made about the differences between men and women. Some have to do with biological differences, some have to do with behavioral differences, which may be seen as connected. One can think of all sorts of tropes that have emerged into the popular culture. One that you reference was John Gray's book from the mid-90s, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. This idea that these differences between men are, in a sense, relatively fixed. What are the basic assumptions that tend to be made about the differences between men and women?
The basic assumptions are easy because everyone knows them. That is, men are aggressive, they're go-getters, they like sex. They don't want relationships, they don't want to talk about emotions, they don't want to ask for directions. Women are caretakers, they're giving, they don't like sex so much, but they maybe want just one partner, that they're not as aggressive, and that they do want to talk about things. Now, what's fascinating is that culturally, those are our social expectations for the sexes, genders. But in fact, in reality, that's not the way most individuals behave. And here's the real point. We have these expectations of what the sexes are, but they in no way actually reflect what the sexes do. And that's a big problem when we start talking about sex, because really when we say sex, we should be talking about biology, but we're almost always talking about gender, which is actually that nature-nurtural thing again.
define gender for us.
Gender is the ways in which we grow up in, expect, and perceive the sexes to behave.
And sex is something that is more fixed. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, it's more or less fixed. Even sex is not as fixed as we would like to hope that it is. Sex is generally, you know, measured genetically. That is an XX or an XY chromosome. If you're XX, you have two X chromosomes, you're female. If you have an X and Y, you're male. That's the sort of zoological definition. But as the biologist Anne Fausta Sterling has really eloquently demonstrated, even that clear genetic distinction doesn't always play out. That is, you can be XX, but be male. You can be XY and be female in genitals, behavior, and all of those sort of things. There's a lot of complexity in the development. And here's the best way to think of this. Instead of thinking of the sexes as opposites, as the sort of John Gray approach, right? Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. Instead of thinking of them as opposites, think of them as the same species, but at two different ends of the continuum of the range of sex in that species. So the continuum, so there's sort of males and females on a big continuum within the same species. We're not two separate things.
And yet, of course, people will say, but there are physical differences between men and women that do exist. Women
Absolutely.
May have the capacity for reproduction of a certain kind, men for another. You're not suggesting that these things aren't significant. They're just less significant than we tend to think of them. Is that correct?
Exactly. You're exactly right. And I get attacked for this. People get very mad when they say, well, you're saying there's no difference between men and women. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying there are significant and important reproduction, body size, muscle fat density. There's some skeletal differences. There's some neuroendocrinological and hormonal pattern differences. There are differences between men and women on average biologically. But the problem that people don't recognize is if you take any individual male and individual female, they're more likely than not to overlap in physical and biological characteristics. So we assume that there's a dividing line with all men on one side and all women on the other, but there's more than 70% overlap in almost everything males and females do. So I'm not saying there's not differences and that those differences don't matter. What I am saying is if we start the question assuming there's a difference, we're doing bad science. We have to ask the question about a human being first and then see whether it falls out into sex differences afterwards.
Biological anthropologist Agustin Fuentes is my guest. He's the author of Race, Monogamy, and Other Lies They Told You. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. So I'd like to return to a point that you touched on, which is this assumption that women are by their nature monogamous and men are non-monogamous, and that in straight couples, women want relationships and men want sex, and they sort of have to find some sort of compromise or rein each other in somehow.
That's a very common perception. And it is not completely without some basis. That is, in our society, if you grow up your whole life as a boy or a girl, hearing that, feeling that, being exposed to that, more often than not, that's going to be part of your outlook on life. That's going to be part of the way you expect a normal relationship to be. This is where the problem comes in, because for humans, that's not necessarily typical. For any given male or any given female, the way in which they feel about sexual behavior, about emotional attachments, about relationships, about families, about even reproduction, is going to be highly variable. And so you have this behavioral variability in individuals and biological variability. But at the same time, our society says, no, you have two choices. You have the male choice and you have the female choice, and you should fit into them. And this disconnect between the massive individual variation we see in humans and the societal expectations of uniformity of gender are really problematic.
So what is the basis of the predominance of monogamy in our society? Is it rooted in anything that is biological, a need for two people to reproduce and then be together in such a way that would allow for children to be raised, or some sort of logic, you know, along those lines?
What's fascinating, the more we know about human evolution and human bodies and human behavior, we realize that it takes more than two people to reproduce. That whole idea, it takes a village to raise a child, it's in fact true. The strongest evolutionary models for human development now involve cooperative breeding, co-parenting, grandmothering, all of these individuals involved in raising the children. The old model of sort of the nuclear family as our evolutionary heritage has been blown out of the water. It's simply not accurate. But that doesn't mean that humans don't seek to form these things we call pair bonds. these very, very strong physiological and emotional relationships between individuals. Humans can form one of them, two of them, 20 of them across their lifetimes, or sometimes none of them. But humans seek them out. We seek out very, very strong pair bonds. And these can be heterosexual, these can be homosexual. They can involve sex or they can not involve sex. So we conflate or we mix up the idea of monogamy and raising a family with this sort of physiological and evolutionary pattern of pair bonding. Pair bonding is not the same as monogamy. It can translate to monogamous relationship, but it doesn't do so necessarily.
Well, with all the caveats that you mentioned earlier of who we compare ourselves to and what lessons we draw from other primates, how do pair bonds tend to appear within other primates? I know this is an area that you've done a great deal of research in.
Yeah, so a lot of my early work was trying to demonstrate how common monogamy is in other primates. And a lot of people held this up and said, look, monogamy is common to primates. That's why we see it common in humans. It's just not true. It's extremely rare for all animals. It's just not a common pattern of existence. And it's not common in the primates. It's not common in other mammals. So what's really interesting then is that humans tend to have monogamous systems, that is, marriage and economic and political systems, and we tend to pair bond. So that's actually something fairly distinctive about humans relative to other organisms. My research on monogamy in other primates basically killed it. It demonstrated that it wasn't very common at all. So actually going out to show one thing, I did good science and was completely wrong. It was much less common than we thought.
And I assume this is as applicable to the very non-monogamous bonobos as much as it is to the more aggressive chimpanzees?
Yeah, exactly. So across the board, what's very interesting is that we can look to other primates, to other animals to, again, as I said, get some idea how other organisms make a living in the world and try to see what things are related or not related to some patterns that we exhibit. But you can go out into the natural world, that is the world outside of humans that we tend to think of as natural, and find support for any particular one human characteristic. The problem is humans are distinct in many ways from any other organisms. And so going out and asking, is, you know, monogamy common in primates? It turned out no. It's, in fact, more common in humans than it is in any other primate. But the one thing we do learn from studying primates is they have lots of sex, and they use sex outside of reproduction regularly. And that's another thing that is actually characteristic of humans. And we do it more so in humans than other primates, but part of the reason we do it is because we're primates, and it's a primate trend, not a human trend.
And that is the same for women as much as men, is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. Studying sexual behavior is extremely difficult, and especially with humans. I mean, people lie, and you can't basically follow someone around and watch what they do all the time. So actually getting good data on sexual activity is very, very difficult. But the few studies that have been published, starting with Kinsey's work up through the modern day, when people actually talk to people about what they feel and what they do in the sense of actual sexual activity, you find that men and women overlap much more than the popular press or the popular media would have us think.
I want to ask you about one of the stereotypes that is connected to a lot of the things you've been talking about, a stereotype about men, which is the notion of all sorts of characteristics that are meant to be essential to men that come out of man as the hunter, this sort of evolutionary role that men have played, and there's an assumption that men have been the hunters in society and that it has translated into all sorts of common practices. What are the traits that are supposed to come out of this evolutionary history, and then does this evolutionary history actually exist?
Well, so the man the hunter idea, which was very common emerging out of the 60s and 70s, was the idea that men, they go out and they kill something big and bring it back for the women to cut up and cook and give to the kids. This whole idea that men have better hand-eye coordination, they're going to be better at sports, they're going to be better at sort of predicting and tracking down animals, things like that. All of that's tied into our sort of ideas about differences between men and women. Now, cross-culturally, we can't go back in time, so we're unable to say, well, did men hunt in the past? Looking at societies that still hunt today, we can see that men do hunt big game, but women also hunt a lot, especially small game and fish and things like that. But there is a difference between big game hunting and small game hunting. Not all societies hunt big game. But the whole idea that there's this evolutionary trajectory for men as hunters and women as sort of cookers or gatherers or taking care of the family, that's just not supported by the archaeological or the fossil record. We don't know who made the first stone tools. Every depiction you see of them will have a man making stone tools. There's absolutely no reason to make that assumption. So we have to be careful about our sort of gendered lenses and our sort of enculturated lenses looking back into the past. So is Man the Hunter an adaptation? That's been pretty generally and resoundingly refuted. In fact, Robert Sussman and Linda Hart, some anthropologists, have demonstrated that it's more likely Man the Hunted, that is probably running away or getting away from really big, mean things that wanted to eat us, played a more important role in our evolution than did actually hunting those things.
The motive to your book is to try and dismantle a bunch of these myths. And in this hour, you've been pointing to the ways that the multiple ways that these myths are constructed, which raises the question of how does one actually really take them on? Because you point to things that are cultural, political. Obviously, there are structures of inequality that generate a lot of assumptions around presumed biological bases for them. And then there is science, which, as you say, doesn't operate in a vacuum either. So how does one really come at these questions, particularly when, as you write in the book, and as you just illustrated with this Man the Hunter assumption, that you can take a large set of assumptions from a small bit of data and turn them into something that seems essential and fixed and true?
Well, the real challenge here is twofold. One is we have to ask questions. We really have to be critical of what we're told. That is one of the incredible capacities of our big brain, is this ability to hold a bunch of thoughts and to compare them. And we need to take more advantage of that. Our schools don't really teach that anymore. And as a culture, we're really dropping, the United States, I'm saying here, we're really dropping out of our ideas of critical analysis. So the first thing is question stuff. If something doesn't sound right to you or sounds too right to you, ask a question about it. Follow it up a little bit. See where it comes from. The second thing is simply education. There's so much information out there, especially given the internet, that we're just overloaded and people give up or they just turn to Wikipedia or, you know, some sort of simplistic avenue to get information. People need to work pretty hard at getting good quality information. So the two things are challenge authority in the sense of when you hear something, question it. Try to figure out why it's being pushed at you that way or why it's being presented that way. And the second thing is go out and do the legwork. Read, talk to people.
Finally, what about the scientific establishment? To what degree has it been culpable in all of this? Because obviously some of these ideas have at times been the received wisdom.
Well, I think we're too quiet. I think there's many, many, many excellent researchers out there doing great science that really has something to say about our world today. But the way in which we're sort of tied into peer review publications and grant funding for all the kinds of research we do, there's really no or very little inspiration to get out there and blog, to get out there and publish popular books, to get out there and do radio and television shows. I think there needs to be much more public intellectualism. Scientists, in addition to doing all of their academic requirements, really need to be pushed to get out more into the public and to spread that information. The stuff we research and find out is no good if we only keep it to ourselves. It has to be disseminated, and it has to be disseminated more broadly than it currently is.
And it also sounds like what you're saying is that there really need to be public debates around some questions, because if science is also political, then obviously there's not just one answer, and there's not going to be, and certainly scientists can also promulgate ideas that perhaps you might find problematic.
Absolutely. I think debates are the way to go. I wish there were televised debates twice weekly or 12 times weekly. I wish radio shows were widely listened to when they broadcast these kinds of debates. I think it's very, very good to get out there and disagree and then to demonstrate why you disagree and have an intellectual engagement with it. In the day and age of reality television, you think almost people would like that. I mean, I don't expect scientists to sort of hit each other over the head with chairs, but lively debates, real engagement with ideas about sex, aggression, race, that's possible. We just need to do more of it.
Agustin Fuentes, it's been a great pleasure.
Thank you.
This and all previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive, unwelcomeguests.net/archive. The music is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Lee Guthrie. Keep giving all you can.